Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like to welcome Jean Kilborn. She's the author of the book, So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So considering, as you say in your book, that all human beings are born sexual beings, what do you mean by sexualized and what's the new part of it?
Well, that's probably the most important question you could ask because people get so confused by that. And there's a world of difference between sexuality and sexualization. You know, sexuality is something that's with us from birth and it's to be celebrated. It's an incredibly important part of being a human being. Sexualization is about turning people into objects, into things. So sexualization is always bad. It's always harmful. And that's part of what's new is that there's so much of it these days, and also that it's starting to affect younger and younger children all the time.
What does that look like?
Well, it has many different looks, actually. When Diane and I started writing this book, we've been hearing a lot of stories from teachers talking about little children in kindergarten, for example, playing sort of sexual games or seeming sexually precocious. In a way, we've also heard from parents saying that they were sort of overwhelmed and didn't know what to do about all the pressure on their daughters, for example, to 4 or 5 years old to dress in a very sexy way, or the kinds of stories that they were hearing from their little boys who'd stumbled upon pornography on the internet. So it has many different faces, and it shows up in many different ways, whether it's Halloween costumes for six-year-olds that are pimps and whores, or thong panties and padded bras being sold to seven-year-olds in major department stores, or the kinds of music that trickles down to very little kids. It's everywhere, and it's all around them, and it's targeting younger and younger children all the time.
The part of the book that I thought was most compelling was all the material that you have about how companies, corporations, spend so much money understanding children's psychology. And in the end, they end up knowing more how children work than the children's own parents. And they use that knowledge to sell kids things, to make them into little consumers and so on. And their parents are kind of helpless in the face of that.
That also is a very major point, that the point of all of this sex in ads or everywhere else isn't to sell our kids on sex. It's to sell them on shopping and to get them to link shopping and sex to eroticize shopping very early on, because whatever gets eroticized early in childhood pretty much stays with us for life. So if you can get little children growing up believing that their sexiness, their desirability depends on what they buy, what they're wearing, you'll have them lined up at the mall for the rest of their lives. So that's what's driving this, is the consumerism and the materialism and the corporations that want to turn our children into consumers starting pretty much at birth. They've discovered that babies at the age of 6 months can recognize corporate logos, and that's the age at which they're now starting to target our children. So no wonder parents feel overwhelmed, because parents are, in fact, up against huge multi-billion-dollar multinational corporations that are using state-of-the-art psychological research to target their children.
And it's not that the parents are immune to this. I mean, parents of young children are now in their 20s or 30s, maybe 40s, and these are people who've grown up with maybe not quite the extent of it, but also that media saturation from television and their environment. So for them to sort it out is an educational process in itself.
It definitely is. And in fact, there's a lot of pressure on the mothers of these kids to look very young. So you've come up with this odd phenomenon where the mothers are sometimes dressing like teenagers, and so are the four-year-old children. So they end up kind of in the middle, you know, looking sort of like each other, because the pressure is on the women these days to look sort of incredibly young and to stay hot and sexy, you know, for as long as possible. So that's very much a part of the pressure. And the parents have also been desensitized because of all the exposure all these years to these messages. Now, the truth is, it's much more graphic today than it was even 5 years ago. But if you've grown up surrounded by this, you can just sort of be desensitized and not really notice how much worse things have gotten.
And in your research, they really have gotten worse.
It's gotten much, much worse. Now, I personally have been studying advertising, you know, since the late 1960s. I think, the first person to look at gender in advertising, made my film Killing Us Softly way back in 1979. So I've been tracking this for a very long time. And it's much, much worse today than it was when I started out. And it's worse in several ways. The pressure on women and girls to look perfect is worse than ever before. The ideal image is constructed, you know, more artificially than ever before because of computers. And the emphasis on extreme thinness is worse than before. And also the sexual images are just much more pornographic. And that's because of the mainstreaming of pornography that's taken place in the past few years, which is primarily due to the Internet. Now, the Internet, of course, is wonderful in many ways, but it also has made pornography not only accessible, but really inescapable, so that, you know, what used to be kind of part of a sort of mysterious adult world is now readily available to little children who stumble upon it mostly by accident, of course. But it's what you had to go to a seedy bookstore to get or reach behind a counter to get is now everywhere. And as a result, we've seen a real mainstreaming of pornography in the culture, in fashion, in language, in glorification of porn stars and pimps, in all kinds of ways. Porn has become mainstream and is now seen as kind of cool and edgy and rather than as anything that's shameful or harmful.
Another problem that is a result of this over-sexualized culture is not just that people become consumers to a ridiculous or extreme degree, which some people would make the argument is not in itself a harmful thing. You know, we could talk about that forever, but there's a real harmful thing, which is, for example, in the book, a 7-year-old sitting in the bathtub crying because she says she's fat and she wants to go on a diet. That is the beginning of body image problems that a lot of girls and women and young adolescent girls have that results in things like bulimia and anorexia and Lord knows what else.
That's absolutely true. And in fact, a study came out about the summer before last from the American Psychological Association, which documented the research on the harmful effects of sexualization on girls. And it absolutely, the research is clear. It links sexualization of girls with eating disorders, self-mutilation, low self-esteem, suicide, all kinds of problems. So there's no doubt that this is harmful. I think it's also harmful to boys, although there hasn't been very much research done on that yet. But it's certainly important to include boys in the discussion. And I would say, just to say about consumerism in general, there's plenty of evidence also that sort of wild consumerism is harmful, too. I mean, it's obviously harmful to the planet, but even to individuals, people like Juliet Shore, her brilliant book Born to Buy, talked about how this kind of consumerism and materialism can make children very anxious, depressed. It has some very harmful effects. So it's none of this is benign.
Tell us some of the stories that parents have come to you with.
Maybe I can start with a story about my own daughter who years ago when she was 11 years old, said to me, Mommy, what's oral sex? She said, I think I know, but I want to be sure. Well, I wasn't quite ready for this question at this stage, but I said, well, honey, what do you think it is? And she said, I think it's when you talk about it. So,
oh, my goodness.
Which is a wonderful example of how many kids have a kind of veneer of sophistication, but they're really misinformed. Now, there was a part of me, of course, that wanted to say, that's right. But what I did say was talking about sex is incredibly important. You know, communication is a big part of sex, but that's not what's meant by oral sex, because I didn't want her to be humiliated by, you know, telling her friends that she knew what it was and then, you know, being wrong. So I told her, even though it was sooner than I, you know, would have expected. And, I think that sort of really does exemplify, as I said, how they can be misinformed but think they know something, and also how important it is when a child does ask a question to the first thing to do is to find out what the child really means, because often the child is looking at something from a very different point of view than the adult, and so you might launch into an explanation that's miles away from what the child is really asking. So that's why it's, I think, important to start there. But there are many other stories. There was a story about a little boy, I think he was maybe 5 years old, who said to a little girl in his class, "I want to have sex with you." And, of course, there was a huge uproar, and his parents were brought in, and he was about to be expelled, and no one had thought to ask the child what he meant by that. And it turns out, when he was asked, he burst into tears and said, I like her. I wanted to kiss her. I mean, he had no idea what he was saying. And so that's another reason why it's so important to find out what the child is thinking and meaning by that. Or another child, even younger, who drew pictures of women with huge breasts and wrote big boobies all across it. And you know, some teachers might have just been horrified and said, you know, "Johnny, stop that." But this, luckily, he had a sensitive teacher who asked him what this was about. And it turned out that he'd been watching the wrestling shows on television with his older brother. And he was actually confused and scared by them. And this was his way of trying to kind of process that. And the teacher, luckily, was able to help him because the teacher asked the right questions. So there's a lot that we can do to help children through these minefields, but we need to be very, first of all, aware of the fact that children experience the world very differently than adults do. Their developmental process is very different, and we really do need to listen to them and to talk with them at their level.
We're talking to Jean Kilborn, co-author of the book So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. I think one of the ways in which the book is very valuable is helping parents talk to their children in ways that don't crush the child and in ways that, for example, asking open-ended questions really let the kid talk and not feel like he or she is on the spot.
Absolutely. And I think if I had to sort of give just one piece of advice to parents, it would be communicate, have a lot of conversations with your children starting very, very young, and create an atmosphere in which the child feels completely safe asking you about anything and knows that he or she won't be shamed or rebuffed or, you know, made to feel embarrassed for having asked the question, but rather that you'll do your absolute best to answer it, you know, again, in an age-appropriate way. But creating that environment, starting when the children are very, very young, will pay rich dividends when they get older. And you'll be able to have much better conversations with them as they hit their teenage years. But having said that, if you know someone's listening who's a parent of a teenager, don't despair, because it's never too late to start these conversations. And you know, we live in a culture in which most adults don't feel very comfortable talking about sex or sexuality. I mean, it's kind of weird culture, really, because it's sex saturated and sex crazed. And sex is used to sell us everything, but it's also kind of puritanical, and we, you know, refuse to teach sex ed in our schools, and again, most adults don't feel comfortable talking about sex, even with each other. So for parents, we've just got to get over it, because if we don't talk to our kids about it, they're going to get the messages from their peers, they're going to get the messages from the popular culture, and they won't be the kinds of messages that most parents want their kids to get. So we need to just, you know, take a deep breath and start talking. And I don't mean, you know, the big lecture, the birds and the bees or anything. I mean having, you know, small conversations where you start maybe by asking the child, you know, "What do you think about this?" Or by encouraging the child to, you know, feel pleasure in his or her body, to not be shamed for that. You know, there are many different things that parents can do, but and if it's you're the parent of a teenager and you haven't done anything before, you can even start by saying, "You know, I'd started these conversations when you were very little, but I didn't, and this is awkward for me, and I'm sure it's awkward for you, but I really want to know what's going on in your life and how you're feeling about all these messages that surround you and what I hear going on with teenagers these days," that kind of thing.
It seems that, and there's some examples of actual conversations, and then it's sort of two columns. In one, there's the conversation that the parent and child are having, and the other, there's a kind of analysis. Okay, here's what the kid is thinking, and here's what you're doing when you give this answer. But I think it's very important to really answer the questions that they're asking and not more than that, because sometimes the kid just wants to know one little thing, and then 6 months later they'll come back and ask another thing, and then a year after that they'll ask another thing, and they don't want more. and they're not ready for more than what they're specifically asking for.
Yeah, that's very important, and to just stop and to ask the child, you know, well, what do you mean exactly, and how does that, you know, how do you feel about that, and what would you like to know, and then stop and then see what the child says, because all too often we rush in, you know, with information that just overwhelms the child, and as you said, is not at all what the child is really ready or to hear or even asking for.
A moment ago, you said that we live in this simultaneously sex-saturated culture, and we have a puritanical attitude about it. Those things have to be related.
Well, I guess in some ways they are. I mean, there are many cultures that deal with sex very differently than we do. And I suppose, I mean, I see ours partly coming from our literal Puritan heritage, you know. So there, and the whole role that religion plays in our culture and all of that. So I suppose they're also related in that, you know, in the one area, it's sex is sort of suppressed and repressed, and then it comes out in this sort of pornographic,
exactly,
blatant sort of way. So in that sense, certainly there, I think there is a relationship.
I mean, even, you know, the red states and the Bible Belt states are larger users of pornography per capita than we are.
Yes, I know. That's interesting, isn't it? At the same time that they will only teach abstinence education,
exactly,
in the schools. And what we're doing, of course, then, is we're basically sacrificing our children, because the states that have most used abstinence-only education have the highest rates of teen pregnancy, the highest rates of sexually transmitted illnesses by far. So our children are paying a huge price for our mixed-up attitudes about sex.
I think it must be tricky for you and your co-author and other people working on the material that you're working on to walk a line where you're not coming off as prudish. I mean, some of the examples, some of the stories of young people in the book, you know, a girl goes shopping with, 12-year-old girl goes shopping with her mother for a dress to wear to the dance, and her mother won't let her buy a sexy dress, and her daughter says, "You are such a prude," and they have a huge fight about it. And mm-hmm. it, likewise, for people doing the kind of work that you're doing and really analyzing the over-sexual, you know, what you think of as over-sexualization of childhood, how do you make sure that your own puritanism and prudishness isn't coming into it?
As if I had some, you mean?
Right? Well, I'm not saying you do, but, you know, our whole, maybe your whole, my whole generation, it can't help but having grown up with that. It was everywhere.
Well, it was, but I think, you know, what we try to do is be very explicit and always say, look, there's, as I said, did in the beginning, there's a world of difference between sexuality and sexualization, that sexuality is to be celebrated. We very much advocate more sex education in the schools, accurate, honest, age-appropriate sex education. And I think one thing that helps is to say that, you know, we've all been kind of almost brainwashed into thinking that sex is all about products and all about sort of the kinds of encounters that the pop stars and the celebrities have and that we see everywhere on television and in films, that's what it's about. And in my mind, this is really actually anti-erotic, because what it does is it creates, the message from the popular culture is that sex belongs only to the young and beautiful. If you're not young and perfect looking, you have no sexuality. You know, you just literally never see older people who are presented as sexual except in creepy ways. And so I think the ultimate effect is actually to deaden sexuality in the culture, to make most people feel less desirable. It certainly makes women feel less desirable. How sexy can you be if you hate your body or if you can't bear to be seen in the light, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't think it helps men either, because there's such an emphasis on performance, and it makes everybody feel as if, you know, their own sex life is dismal by comparison to what's going on, you know, all around them. So the ultimate impact, you know, of all of this isn't pro-sex. It's really kind of anti-sex in a way. It doesn't have anything to do with real human sexuality. And so, you know, to accuse me or anybody who's saying all this as being prudish is to really profoundly miss the point.
I think the word that you never hear in all of this is heart. In other words, when there's a heart-centered sexuality, then all these other considerations sort of fall away.
Yes, and that's a beautiful way to put it, I must say, a heart-centered sexuality. And that's certainly what we talk about in the book is that this ideally, you know, should be, sex should be related to intimacy, to relationship. And that doesn't mean, by the way, that it always has to be. But, I mean, I think certainly for young people, that's very important. And one of the big problems with sexuality as it's portrayed in our culture is that it's so often entirely divorced from relationship or from any concept of intimacy. I mean, there's a Budweiser ad that I use in my one of my presentations that shows the sort of torsos of a young man and a young woman, very thin woman, of course, kind of intertwined. And the copy says, names optional. So the ad is clearly saying, you know, get drunk, have sex. You don't even need to know the name of the person you're with. And that kind of attitude is so promoted by the culture. And I think we're seeing its effects in the kinds of casual sex that a lot of young people are having, the kinds of girls servicing boys in middle school that we hear about, the friends with benefits, the hooking up. And, you know, I don't think it's prudish to object to that, because I think it's pretty clear that this is harmful to young people. It's definitely harmful to girls. And again, I don't think it does boys any favors either.
When you look at the people who were teenagers 5-10 years ago who were involved in that kind of activity, what are the lasting detriments in their adulthood? Have you followed kids who were, like, girls who were, as you say, servicing boys in school when they were teenagers and so on, into their young adulthood?
Some. I mean, there hasn't been any sort of gold standard research done on this yet, but there's been some that indicates that this can lead to difficulty, you know, forming relationships, difficulty making connections for boys as well as for girls. Because one of the wonderful things about the teenage years should be that you learn a whole lot about yourself and your body and your sexuality and relationships. You know, almost always, you know, you fall in love when you're a teenager, your heart gets broken, you feel like you're never going to survive the heartbreak, and you learn a lot about relationships and how to deal with them and all of that, which then is a necessary step towards having those kinds of relationships in adulthood. And if you skip that step, you know, if you go right to having sex and not having it be really even part of a relationship, then you lose a whole lot of the time and the sort of the wonder and the mystery and all of that of the gradual unfolding of sexuality during your adolescence.
One of the important things that needs to be done, besides parents really learning to talk to their children, is media education. Once you decode the messages that advertising is giving you, they become a lot more transparent and a lot less effective to even to young people who are doing that analysis.
That's absolutely true, and that's why one of the things that we strongly recommend in the book is teaching media literacy in the schools. Starting early on, the United States is the only developed nation in the world that doesn't teach media literacy, and also the only developed nation in the world that doesn't teach sex education. So if we taught media literacy, helping our kids starting very early on to become critical viewers of the media, to understand, you know, that these images are constructed, to understand how the media work, I think that would go a long way towards helping them be less manipulated. And that's something I've been arguing for, again, since the late 60s, that I think I was the first person to sort of promote the idea that media literacy could be used as a tool for prevention of many public health problems, whether it's eating disorders or addiction or violence against women. And I do consider the sexualization of childhood a public health problem. It's something that affects all of us. It affects all children, and some more than others, obviously, but it affects all of us. And so we need to address it, you know, as a public health problem. And one way to do that is to teach media literacy.
We're talking to Jean Kilbourn, co-author of the book So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. There is an aspect of addiction that runs through this conversation and a lot of other conversations that one hears about. Everybody talks about drug addiction and alcohol addiction, but there's also a lot of work now about food addiction and what food manufacturing companies are doing to keep people addicted to fat and sugar and salt and things like that, and video game addiction. And all of this, if you think of it together, is part of a greater social set of patterns.
It is indeed. It includes sex addiction as part of that as well. And it can seem, in the beginning, or sometimes to people, it can seem as if this is somehow trivializing, you know, that the so-called real addictions are alcoholism and drug addiction, other drug addiction, and that sort of thing. And in many ways, those addictions are more life-threatening and even more destructive. But there are many different forms. One can certainly look upon food as having some addictive properties. One can certainly look upon sex addiction, gambling, shopping, all of these things. And it's turning out that a lot of this is related to just brain chemistry, that what happens with these kinds of addictions is we sort of manufacture chemicals in our brain that make us high, you know, and we get addicted to that, to these, so that it's not, it's the, you know, the shopping or the gambling or the having lots of sexual encounters, something like that. We actually get addicted to the high that we kind of create in our own brain. So it is, I think it really can be considered addiction. There's no question about that. And it's all, it does serve, most of it serves consumerism, certainly. You know, certainly people being addicted to junk food, for example, is good for the junk food makers and, you know, the people who are drinking, you know, 12 bottles a day of soft drinks, that's really good for the soft drink makers. And people who really get high when they go to the mall, you know, just on the experience of going to the mall, that's good for all of the sellers as well. So a lot of this is in the service of, again, encouraging people to become consumers and to feel that life, happiness in life comes from what we buy and what we ingest and what we take in, that sort of thing, rather than from what I think really yields happiness, which is meaningful relationships and meaningful work.
I couldn't help thinking when I was reading your book was that it's not just about blocking all of these media messages from kids' lives, although certainly for many parents there's a kind of desperate desire to do so, but it's also about adding things that are much more fun anyway, like running around outdoors, riding bikes and swimming and playing hide and seek, which a lot of parents don't let their children do because they're scared of the one in a million chance they'll be abducted or whatever. And so a lot of these kids are staying home, they're indoors, they're in rooms, and that's when this media stuff can come in, first of all, and the states of consciousness that happen to your body that get you high in natural ways or just that keep your brain chemistry balanced in natural ways, like running around, aren't happening.
That's also true, and there's so many places I could sort of jump off from there. One thing is that, of course, that you're right that children are kept at home because parents are afraid of the outside, but the most dangerous place for most children is at home. You know, that's where they're most likely to be sexually abused. It's more where they're most likely to be physically abused. So the hype about stranger abuse and about the dangers that are lurking out there for our children has really terrorized people and made people keep their kids indoors, which in turn makes puts the kids at greater risk, but it also makes the outdoors less safe because one of the things that makes the outdoors safer is having more people out there. So, you know, if you're at a playground and there are lots and lots of kids and parents, that's going to be a whole lot safer than if it's more or less deserted. So that's very important. And you're also right that this is not about just saying no to kids about what they shouldn't be doing, but rather opening up the world to much more experience. There's a heartbreaking book, I can't remember the name of it now, that about how children are totally losing touch with nature. Very few children really have the opportunity to just go out and roam around and experiment and be out in nature, and what a huge loss that is, not only to the child, but also in many ways to the environment, because, you know, people who don't experience nature tend not to appreciate it and therefore not to care so much about preserving it. So we could all pay a huge price for this. But I mean, I remember as a child a very long time ago, you know, just going out and, you know, riding my bike places and having a treehouse and going with my friends into the woods and building teepees and doing all kinds of things. And, you know, I think that there's so much less of that now, and that's really, I think it's a tragedy.
And it's related to this whole, the whole rest of this kind of addiction phenomenon.
Absolutely. There's, I think, a huge amount of boredom among kids now, so that they're given video games and they're plopped in front of the TV, and they're given all kinds of stuff to do in that regard. But it doesn't really involve their imagination. It doesn't involve their creativity. These things quickly lose their interest, and then kids get bored, and then they need to be stimulated again, so they're given something else. And so they end up needing a whole lot of stimulation and not being able to entertain themselves. And that really also is incredibly sad, because it's extraordinarily important, I think, part of life to be able to entertain and amuse oneself.
Was that term that you were looking for called nature deficit disorder, last child in the woods?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. That's so important. I mean, that really, some of the happiest memories of my childhood involve being outdoors, you know, on the beach and by the ocean, and often, you know, with other children and not with adults sort of following us and all of that. You know, it was, we would sort of go out in the morning and come back when it was dark.
Well, exactly. You know? I mean, I was fortunate enough to experience that as well. And while it's important for parents and teachers to really observe what's going on with their kids and to spot problems, I wonder if there also isn't not enough leaving kids alone, leaving them to work things out for themselves with each other, and not have quite so much parental interference.
There's definitely not nearly enough of that. And kids are, and a lot of people say this, of course, are so incredibly overscheduled these days, you know, with their various lessons and sports and being driven from one place to the next and having very little time when they can just hang out, you know, and figure out ways to entertain themselves and not feel pressured to have to do something or achieve something. So, and there's lots and lots of research and books about the kinds of pressure on kids and how they respond, which is often, you know, with everything from attention deficit disorder to depression to anxiety to many other things. So our kids pay a real price for the loss of their childhood.
One thing that I think is important is to draw, as I think you do in your book, a distinction between sex and violence. A lot of the time that phrase is used as if the two things were synonymous or as if they always went together instead of being opposites. It really, one being a beautiful, life-giving event and the other being ways of killing and causing death and pain, sex and violence. How do you separate those things in the minds of kids who always hear them together?
Well, it's very difficult because they're so often linked throughout the media. You know, in the video games, certainly, in the movies, in the TV shows, there's an awful lot of eroticizing violence. And the research is very clear that violent images do affect us. There's no question about that anymore. They make some people more violent, more aggressive, and they make everybody less sensitive. They desensitize us to violence, and they may also make it more likely that people will blame the victim. And so the research is clear about that. And the research is also clear that the most dangerous thing to do is to link sex with violence, to eroticize violence, because that gives it a sort of double charge and makes it, again, more difficult for people to sort it out and not to be aroused by it, and especially when you bring this into very young children's lives. So it's very important to do everything we can. I mean, a good sex education class, of course, would talk about relationships and about intimacy and about sex in a joyful way. Part of the trouble with the way that sex has been taught in this country is sex education is that it's all about how sex can hurt or kill you, but not anything about joy or about intimacy. So sort of more of an emphasis on that would be helpful. But and also, again, media literacy, pointing out the uses of sex and violence to get our attention and to sell us stuff and that kind of thing might also help us be a little less influenced by it. But there's no doubt that it's a really huge problem because, you know, sex and death are the two big subconscious forces, and when you link them, you can really grab people's attention and make them notice, and that's, of course, what marketers are after.
One thing that I think is dangerous is trying to go backwards to what somebody might consider a golden age. And certainly you have a vision of the 1950s, which is hardly a golden age because the dark side of it was so huge. I mean, you had a kind of a sexually repressed thing going on, which resulted in the sexual liberation movement of the 60s and all sorts of things. So given that there's probably not some golden age that we could return to even if we wanted to, what do you think would be a healthy environment for young people and their parents in terms of sexual awareness and development for kids?
Well, you're absolutely right that, I mean, the 50s certainly wasn't a golden age, and there was an enormous amount of repression and an awful lot of stuff going on that wasn't talked about at all. I mean, we didn't ever talk about sexual abuse, for example, or the kinds of battering that was going on or anything like that. There was one thing to be said for it, which I said to my daughter, you know, when we were talking about the hooking up and the friends with benefits and everything, and I said, well, at least growing up in the 50s, for all the repression, girls did get 4 years of foreplay during high school. You know, there was a whole lot of gradual sort of awakening into sex for most of us that was, in that sense, positive, although there was certainly a whole lot of guilt and stuff associated with it as well. So what I'd like to see, of course, would be the kind of situation, culture, in which young people were not shamed, were not taught that their bodies were disgusting or that sex was terrifying or anything like that, but rather were allowed to grow up gradually and have a gradual unfolding of sexual awareness and sexual exploration and all of that. Always, of course, without coercion. One of the terrible things that's happening these days is a huge percentage of young teenage girls' first experiences with sex are forced. So, but it should be without coercion in the context of a relationship, and in which all children are educated about how to protect themselves, how to say no, how to also say yes, you know, in an appropriate way, and to be aware of their bodies and how their bodies work and all of that. I mean, that would be sort of wonderful. And that may sound kind of pie in the sky, but there are cultures that do a whole lot that are pretty close to that, actually, in terms of the way that children are educated and the ways in which people talk about sex and sexuality. And those cultures have much, much lower rates of teen pregnancy and of sexually transmitted illnesses.
We're talking to Jean Kilbourn, co-author of the book So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. You say in your introduction that there are a lot of cultural differences where all this stuff is concerned, and you don't have time to go into it in the book, but what are some of these cultures that do a good job?
Well, many of the countries in the European Union do a good job. The Scandinavian countries do a good job. I mean, a terrific job, really, of educating children about sex and sexuality and of making sure that they have access to condoms and to all the information that they need. My daughter spent a year abroad in Amsterdam, and she did a fascinating paper on the differences in the ways that Dutch teenagers talk with their parents about sex versus American teenagers. And it was incredibly eye-opening. I mean, the Dutch teenagers she interviewed, I mean, this wasn't a scientific study, but she got some wonderful stories from the Dutch teenagers about how easy and open the conversations were with their parents and sort of always had been, and how there was humor and warmth and openness and real information versus the kinds of, you know, uptight, awkward misinformation that goes on so often in American households. Now, not all, of course, but many parents do a great job with this, but culturally speaking, you know, we're not at all advanced in terms of the ways that we deal with sex in our children.
The last time I looked, Holland had the world's lowest abortion rate.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that would be related because, you know, in an ideal world, we would make abortion safe and legal, but rare, you know, because there wouldn't be unwanted pregnancies. People would be protecting themselves. They would be wouldn't be getting pregnant unless they wanted to have a baby, and that would be wonderful, because that, I think, would make a whole lot of people happy on all sides of the question.
Of course, many people around the world live a whole family in one room. Kids in those cultures are exposed to sexuality, and real sexuality, not media image of sexuality, just by default. Is that a bad thing, a good thing?
Well, I mean, who knows, really? I mean, it's certainly, you're absolutely right that throughout human history that's been the case for a very long time. But that, there's a world of difference between that and coming across, you know, sadistic images of pornography on the Internet. And one of the big problems with porn is that it's so often brutal and violent and is so treats women with such contempt. So that would be... It's very different for a child, you know, to sort of come across images like that or to see the kinds of images that are all around us in the media and being in a society where a child would witness or hear, more likely, sexual activity. I'm not enough of an anthropologist to know sort of what the long-term ramifications of that are, but I do know that it's harmful and confusing and scary for children to be exposed to the kinds of images that they're exposed to here.
It's no coincidence that, I don't know if it was you or your co-author, but one of you was disinvited from speaking at a conference on children's health and safety because a toy manufacturer objected to your work.
That was Diane Levin, my co-author. I mean, I've been disinvited to other things for other reasons, but that was, in that case, that was her. I mean, obviously, you know, the toy industry, the fashion industry, you know, the people who are profiting from this aren't going to be our greatest fans. And they have tremendous, you know, sway over what gets covered, you know, what goes on in the media, all sorts of things, because they tend to also own, you know, own lots of media companies, et cetera. So it becomes very difficult to get alternative points of view out there, really.
Is it beneficial for parents to get rid of their television sets, to limit screen time, to put blocks on websites and things like that?
Well, I wouldn't advocate that parents get rid of their television sets. I mean, for one thing, I think there's some good stuff on television, and, you know, certainly some good stuff for adults, and there's, you know, some stuff that's not even bad for kids. The big problem is kids spending so much time watching television. And the problem there isn't just that they're what they might be seeing, but that it's what they're not doing. You know, that they're not exploring or going outdoors or doing other things. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no screen time at all for children under the age of two.
Right.
That means no computers, no TV sets at all, because it so interferes with their developmental process. But other than that, I think that it's quite possible for parents to, you know, use the DVR and to record programs or to get movies that children can enjoy, that the family can enjoy together. And I certainly think parents should limit exposure, and that's easier to do, of course, when our kids are young. But we're not in favor of sort of just say no or ban all media, as if you could. And we're not media bashers. I mean, we recognize that there's some really good stuff out there. There's some great music and there's some great, you know, shows and great films and that kind of thing. And anyway, it's a huge part of our culture. And the best thing, I think, is to educate children about it so that they're able to navigate it better and to limit the exposure as much as you can, particularly when they're young.
There's another aspect of this whole conversation that I was wondering about, which is, does it make a difference also when kids get enough physical contact at home, when they're hugged, when they get to sleep with their parents as babies and things like that? And I was thinking of that in terms of one of the examples you gave in the book where kids in middle school or whatever are doing sandwich dances where two people are dancing on each side of another person. You know, there's a lot of ways to interpret that, but one of them is, wow, I wonder if those kids are all just touch-deprived.
That's a very interesting observation, and I think that certainly might be true. I mean, I certainly think that it's incredibly important for parents to be affectionate with their children and to tell them they love them and all of that. And I think a strange thing does happen often for fathers when their daughters reach adolescence, that fathers become... they just freeze. They don't know what to do. You know, they feel awkward, and they're leery of sort of having a lot of physical contact with their daughters, and so they might suddenly stop, you know, and withdraw, which the daughter, you know, a 12 or 13-year-old girl is going to interpret in a very different way. So it's important, I think, to have, you know, be physically affectionate with one's children, and I think that would help in terms of, you know, kids not feeling sort of touch-deprived, particularly, again, these young girls, 12 or 13, who, if they are touch-deprived or feel that they're not getting warmth elsewhere, are going to turn to it, you know, turn to boys and try to get it that way. And unfortunately, that often doesn't work very well for them.
Well, there's so much good that has been done by the whole phenomenon of sexual abuse, especially sexual abuse within the family, being brought into the light of day and no longer hidden away as an ugly family secret. But I think one of the unintended consequences of that is a lot of suspicion on perfectly innocent touch between parents and children.
I think you're right about that. And I also think that's true with teachers, you know, that there are lots of teachers who are now afraid to hug children or to you know, have any kind of physical contact with children. That, to me, is really sad. And I absolutely, there's a huge amount of sexual abuse that's going on, and we need to be aware of that. We need to teach children about good touch and bad touch and to report, you know, anything that makes them feel uncomfortable. But I don't think the solution is to say to adults, you should never have physical contact with a child. I mean, that really is depriving both the adult and the child of an extraordinarily important part of the human experience.
I think that you know, no matter how much of this media stuff that people get, and again, it's way worse than it was when I was a little kid in the 60s and 70s and so on, but we all played with Barbie dolls and we lived to tell the tale and grow up and have relationships and all of that. Children are resilient, and with just some resources, they can get through this stuff.
Children are resilient, but they really do need the resources. I mean, the Barbie, for example, I mean, Barbie's a nun compared to the Bratz dolls. You know, the Bratz dolls are heavily made up. They're wearing sort of sex worker outfits, and they're very popular with little girls, 3, 4, 5 years old. And again, a child playing with a Bratz doll a couple of times isn't going to ruin the child. But if the child grows up constantly getting the message that all that matters is how she looks and that she needs to be incredibly pretty and hot and sexy and thin and all of this, and this message comes from everywhere, it's going to have a tremendous impact on her. And we're going to have terrific resources offered to her in order to prevent that negative impact. So it is, you know, things really are different. Parents say that they find parenting very difficult these days, and I think it actually is more difficult these days. And one of the reasons is that in the past, the cultural values were more or less in sync with the values most parents had. Not entirely, but more or less. So that when you were parenting, you felt supported by the culture. In this case, today, I think that most of us feel opposed by the culture. I certainly felt that I raised my daughter in a culture that was hostile to everything I wanted for her, that I had to fight all of the cultural messages every step of the way. And that was exhausting, and I was, of course, doomed to fail because this isn't something that parents can do one at a time all by ourselves. So it is more difficult than before, which is, again, why we need to look at this as a public health problem and really work to try and change this environment.
At the same time, it strikes me that probably sexual abuse or even ugly behavior in the household is at least as harmful as the media stuff and the absence of that, and in fact the presence of something else, namely warmth and intelligence in the household, makes up for a lot of that other stuff.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, there's nothing worse than sexual abuse. It's just what it does to children is just horrific, and it takes an awful lot of help to get over it. People do get over it, and they get past it, and they do survive, but it almost always requires a whole lot of help, and that is horrible. But I would contend that some of these images, and it's not the same, it's not nearly as bad as actual sexual abuse, but it's almost a kind of abuse because of what the kinds of messages that it gives kids about sex and about their bodies and the kinds of harm that it can do. And again, not in the same scale, but obviously, there's a world of difference between growing up in a situation where one is sexually abused and anything else, really. But if children are lucky enough, and so much of this is really the luck of what you draw at birth, to be in a loving home with parents who care and who are warm and loving and physically affectionate, then of course that child is going to have a huge advantage.
Jean Kilbourn is co-author of the book So Sexy, So Soon, The New Sexualized Childhood and What Parents Can Do to Protect Their Kids. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We are podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.